Hey guys, we are broadcasting from Joshua Tree, California, and it is a very bright, sunny desert, and so we're going to put on sunglasses now, and we hope that you'll forgive us, but it hurts too much.
We had a long discussion about how alienating it would be to have this podcast wearing sunglasses, and it might very well be alienating, let us know, but there's no way to sit out here and actually not wear sunglasses. I think I would get like the kind of snow burn that you get. I remember one time I tried to climb Mount Adams and I wasn't wearing sunglasses because I was like, I don't need sunglasses. It was a bad decision. You need sunglasses.
Yeah, I think I would just end up with a permanently scrunched face for the rest of the day.
Yeah, you see the, even the Eskimos on the, I don't think I'm supposed to say that, even the Inuit on the snow had like special snow goggles to protect them from the glare.
Little like slits carved in them?
Yeah, exactly. It's like you can't, it's too bright. Everything's white and everything is reflecting and it is hot.
And we could have shot this inside, but that would have been no fun. So anyways, we're out here in the desert. And today we are talking about the future of technological progress. Because we're driving across the country and we listen to this podcast on the Joe Rogan Experience with Ray Kurzweil, who is a sort of, what would you say, mob boss of technological utopianism. Can we be more generous?
Sure.
He has been expressing a vision of the future with respect to AI for longer than almost anyone I can find, at least find videos of. And so we actually went back and listened to some 1980s broadcasts where he was promoting the same ideas a bit more fluidly, but the same basic principles were on the table maybe 40 years ago.
Like, press the accelerator as fast as possible into the future. Technology will save us. There is few, if any, negative side effects of technological progress. And let's do it. Hopefully we'll live forever at some point in there as well. And
it seems like the attitude towards this phenomenon, the increasingly accelerating pace of technological development, particularly with respect to computers, has been driving a huge divide in society that we see in every aspect, from academic physics to culture war landscape. And so we wanted to really take a moment and talk about our thoughts that we were having as we were listening to this, and also how it relates to all these other conversations we've had throughout the year with respect to the technological future and what humans will be, what we should be.
And who we are, right? Because it's like, I think that something we came to over and over again in this conversation is the question of human nature and the way that a lot of futurists think that human nature will change in the very near future through our melding with technology. We didn't really get into rationalism too much in this, but I think that that's kind of the ideal technological, techno-futurist world, is that everyone is a perfectly rational, perfectly intelligent actor. And there's a lot of nuance to that about, you know, what if being human means that you're not perfectly rational? What if you make decisions that no machine could ever possibly make, and that's actually a better outcome than just farming all of our decisions away to machines, which is what we seem to be skating towards uncontrollably?
And it seems like this is something people have been concerned about for quite a while. And so we were getting prepped for this conversation last night. We read a bunch of old sci-fi short stories that were sort of looking at the future of automation and the future of artificial intelligence. And it seems like the roots of these concerns perhaps go thousands of years back. We can get into the mythology a bit, but it's a big topic and we needed to talk about it. So here we are.
Yeah. Let us know what you think in the comments. And if you enjoy the conversations that we have on this show, consider coming over to patreon.com. We're at patreon.com/demystifysci and are currently entirely supported by patron donations. It's what lets us do the conference. It's what lets us do the podcast full time. And if you have the spare cash, consider coming over and giving us a couple dollars a month, because it is vital for us to be able to keep creating content that is dealing with all of the questions about the future that are not being talked about anywhere else. And in return, you get the episodes early every week, and you get to join our patron community, which meets on Sundays on Zoom for an hour where we basically just talk about the big questions that everyone's been thinking about in the week since that we last met.
It's really the most efficient way to support investigations too, right? You're literally paying for the investigation itself. You're not paying for some product that we have to pay middlemen out of or anything that's going to divert us from the actual inquiry that we're trying to do on this show. So be part of it and help us out. We'll really appreciate it. Otherwise,
we'll see you in Austin very shortly. Like, we're going to release this literally days before the conference. And so it might be too late for you to arrange travel to Austin. And if that's the case, you can join us on the live stream. Tickets are for sale at the Eventbrite link, which is right up here. And we're going to have 4 or 5 different talks. We're going to do a little workshop about material atomics. And if you come to the live stream, you will be able to hear all of that and enjoy and participate in real time, even without being there. Thank God for technology.
Mm. But what will we do with it?
Let's find out.
The scientific revolution starts now.
Let us see in the dark.
It seems like right now we're living in a time where computational intelligence has become the most important thing that we're aiming our society for. And I wonder if that isn't a bad idea.
But technologists like Ray Kurzweil and computational scientists seem to think that it is because it's congruent with the nature of the universe. In other words, everything in the universe can be reduced to something computational, and therefore nature wants better and better computation. It's like computationally aligned value structure. It's very interesting. You encounter it in physics, you encounter it in consciousness research, you encounter it in the techno-futurists.
And for a long time, I've been looking for a reason to justify why I think that purely computational physics is an alarming focus for physics to take. Because, I mean, you tell people about the fact that, like, hey, maybe there's a material down there. And a lot of the times they seem to be like, okay, well, why should I care? And it's a hard thing to explain because you're like, okay, well, maybe you should care because you should live in a universe that makes sense. Maybe you should care for all of these other reasons. But what if the reason that you should care is that if computation is all there is, you create a value structure in society for the technologists that can go forth and say, computation is all there is, therefore we must accelerate the rate at which we compute, create these perfect intelligences, and they will run everything for us because there is some natural law at the bottom of the universe that tells us how everything should be. We're not smart enough to see it. The AIs will be, ergo, we need to accelerate in this direction as fast as humanly possible with the hopes of achieving computational utopia.
Right. And what's really strange is when you're trying to win someone over with the reasoning behind why we need a material atomics approach to basic physics, the one thing that will win over somebody like that is being convincing about the fact that you actually need something beyond a computational framework to develop next generation technology. Like, you can iterate on technology really well with computational power, but in terms of having that insight, that real vision for what comes next, you need a qualitative perspective. And so I can conceive of next level energy powers, transport, propulsion, things like this if we understood the atom better. And I don't just mean that we can calculate the things we already understand about the atom with greater precision, but how can we reimagine it so that we could actually accomplish tasks that are problems we don't even know we can't solve right now?
Yeah, exactly. And so that seems also to tie into the question of computation as a central value system, because it's like, okay, if all you can do is compute, do you have wisdom to know what to compute next?
Exactly.
And so I think that there is a break in the way that we consider intelligence, or rather there is a break in how we should think about intelligence, which is that you have on one hand wisdom and on the other hand you have intelligence, And I'm not sure that we have any mathematical formulas for wisdom.
So you kind of, I think it really comes down to how you define intelligence, because when you listen to Kurzweil saying these machines are becoming more and more intelligent and they're going to be more intelligent than humans soon, and that intelligence is all we need to guide our civilization, then you're like, wait a second, what do you mean by intelligence exactly?
And he
can't define it. I've not really seen any of these machines do anything what I would consider intelligent.
Right. And so that's where, if you break out wisdom and intelligence, so like if when somebody says intelligence, in your mind you have this concept that blends wisdom and computation.
Let's define those.
Right. So wisdom is the ability to know what you should choose from the varieties that are in front of you, often intuitive, often like comes from a lineage of thought, right? Like I think that cultural wisdom is the way that like, okay, our people have always done it this way. And so we should always continue to do it this way because this seems to be the thing that works for us. Versus intelligence, which is literally just the like raw abacus crunching of data into output.
There's something that's missing here for me,
okay,
which is the ability, the creative ability to identify problems that weren't there before, falling from like Adam Mastroianni. That there's something really special about these freak human genius minds that reconceive of a situation in completely new terms and all of a sudden open up an extraordinary landscape for intellectual, engineering, political, basically every practice of human existence can be unlocked by these new relationships that are seen, this ability to mash new ideas into each other in a way that I don't see generatively appearing. Now, I know there's like promise of generative AI, but I haven't seen even a trace of this. And when I listen to Kurzweil talking about this exponential increase in intelligence, he clearly isn't considering that kind of intelligence.
So Unzicker talked about this when we had him on the podcast last time, where he was saying that in his view, revolutionary progress in human society comes from the simplification of physics. And he's like, when you were able to simplify the, I think that he was talking about electromagnetism, and you were able to get it down into these four equations, then that helped society progress, because then you had this very simple toolbox that you could use to actually make stuff happen. And so you're basically saying like, look, you might be able to design a machine that can crunch the numbers for you, but you have to have a human who's going to sit around and be like, hey, these are the numbers that we should maybe be focusing on. These are the questions that we should be focusing on.
Yeah, I just have a sense that quantitative formulation really helps at refining processes that you conceptually understand to begin with. But I feel like you're limited by the conceptual space in which you attack the quantitative problem. Like quantitative arguments always have to be bounded by a lot of English to explain what the hell system we're talking about and what the variables mean, mm-hmm, and you know what the implications of the differential relationships are of the variables. And it would be really interesting to me if I could see more of that. And maybe someone listening is going to be like, oh, check this out. And that'd be great. But I don't see a lot of that generative behavior, that interpretive level behavior. And going back to material atomics and why it matters, it's like, because being able to conceptualize new problems in the fields of propulsion, in the fields of energy production, like we would have, without Eddington's basic concept of fusion in the sun, that wouldn't be something people were working on today, right? He came up with that concept of fusion because they needed a source to power the sun. And everything people had tried, you know, this like heating compression thing, or, you know, even meteors crashing into it, like they were trying everything. Radioactive decay was Jeans's idea. But none of those things worked out. They discovered the sun was made out of hydrogen, not out of heavy elements. They discovered that by compression, the sun would cook itself in a few million years, but all of the geological sciences were pointing at a really, really old Earth. So they're left with that.
And I'm like, listening to Kurzweil, he seems to have this moment where all of a sudden the wisdom, because I refer to this stuff as wisdom, Like, I think that there's traditional wisdom, and then there's also creative wisdom.
But is it, like, wisdom when Tesla conceives of the AC motor?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know. I don't think that's the appropriate word. I mean, we can work with that definition. Wisdom does involve something about experience more than about, like, genius insight. I feel like there's this, like, I don't know a better word than genius insight, but I see people having these, like, breakthroughs, and I don't know if they come from beyond, like, if they're tapping into the human consciousness or something. I mean, maybe that's the best way I can, like, include the concept of wisdom in it.
Maybe it's wisdom, insight, and computation summed together to produce intelligence.
That's probably how I would look at it.
Okay,
yeah.
I like that. I think that that's fine.
So, but that's not what Kurzweil means, sadly.
Right, Kurzweil is just computational, though, from what I understand of these conversations, I think that there is a sense that the machines will one day awaken into consciousness.
All three domains of this wider intelligence.
Yeah, because I think that, like, consciousness is really those three things operating in an embodied space. I know that a lot of people would be like, there's no necessity to embody for consciousness, but I'm like, based off of how we talk about it, there's people that talk about, you know, conscious fields and all of that stuff. And I'm like, I don't really buy the conscious field so much as I buy the emergence of those three properties from embodiment.
So would you say that all life forms express some degree of computational power, wisdom, and insight?
I mean, they must, right? Because it's like, how do you... computation, so let's look at simplest form, bacteria. Computation in a bacteria has to exist because you have to get some signals from the outside, which you then integrate into some kind of action.
Like, they're an analog computer in some sense in order to stabilize their basic mechanical functionality.
Yeah, like one of the things that you learn really, really early on in biochemistry is signal cascades. And what is a signal cascade if not a, you know, wetware computer that's basically like, okay, these conditions are bad, activate Brownian motion program in order to evade this condition or to move towards the condition if the condition is good, turn off Brownian motion when receptors get this signal rather than that signal and start moving towards it in a goal-directed way. I'm like, that's computation. Simplest possible version of it.
And that's really easy for people to see, right? I'm sure Kurzweil would see it that way too. Like, well, they're just big computational machines. But in terms of demonstrating the other two, how do you pull that off? I mean, I have a sense that intuitively that it is the case. But how would you evidence something like insight or wisdom in a really primitive organism?
I mean, there's differential success. If you basically take a bunch of bacteria and you put them down in a plate and you look to see which ones of them grow the best or move the farthest or utilize resources most effectively, you get a distribution. And that distribution probably is a normal distribution. And most people would just be like, well, that's just like the stochastic noise of how the systems inside the bacteria are computing. But I'm like, what if it's rudimentary insight and wisdom, where it's like a bacteria can make a choice to move towards something versus another thing? Like, let's say there's
two... Or to associate with certain neighbors versus other neighbors.
Right? And it's like, it's not genetically encoded necessarily. It's just some vague change in its like electrochemical state, in the state of its water, like Michael was talking about.
Well, I was going to think about biofilms, right? Mm. Depending on the environment, the community is going to respond differently and create very different landscapes. I'm not the biofilm person here.
The biofilmologist.
But something like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all communities of cells react differently to environments, and they have these complex regulation systems, and I'm just like...
So wisdom's in some sense folded into how to react to your environment in the most effective way.
I would go even farther and say that basically anything that we talk about in terms of behavior is related to how to react to your environment. Any decision that you make is fundamentally about that, don't you think?
There's something about reflecting on the past that I think of when I think of wisdom. And I wonder how that manifests at the bacterial level. There's something about looking, like we contain our wisdom in mythology, in historic recollections, where else do you see wisdom? I mean, it's basically all in mythology.
There's also like idioms, I think, are really...
Poetry, art, music, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, a rolling stone gathers no moss or something. I'm like, that's not necessarily mythology or poetry. It's just kind of this phrase that you're like, oh, that is so. And it's valuable for being so. So, okay, with a bacteria, you're saying that wisdom is necessarily tied into reflecting on the past. And you find it in idioms, poetry, mythology, art, music. And I'm like, okay, so I'll give you that bacteria don't have those, but bacteria are clones of themselves and so must carry some kind of history of their experiences with them that changes the way that they react to future events. And so that would be like a rudimentary form of wisdom. Super rudimentary. Like barely there. But if we define wisdom as being able to respond to past experiences, I'm like, if you take a bacterium that's... The simplest example of this is like passaging in the laboratory. You go from a wild-type sample that you gather in the environment, and then you grow it up into a biofilm, take a sample, grow it up in liquid culture, make a biofilm, grow it up in liquid culture, make a biofilm. These are considered passages. You're basically like cycling it through a certain growth phase. And the way the biofilms look is completely different from the wild type that you collected, let's say, 15, 20 passages ago.
Because it's adapting to its environment and it's learning.
Yeah, and I'm like, how could it be doing that if it doesn't have a sense of intuition about like how it needs to respond? And it has a sense of like, okay, well, I don't need to respond the way that I used to respond.
And that's something that we don't see too much from the computational space of artificial intelligence.
So part of that, I think, might be because we have such rudimentary access to these machines. Like the version of computational intelligence that is happening behind the scenes at Anthropic or at OpenAI or at Google is really, really different from the version that we see. Like we're getting these really hamstrung. Like, do you know what RLHF is?
Mm-mm.
So it's called reinforcement learning with human feedback. And so all of these systems, when they come out of the box, are really chaotic and don't respond properly to queries. And so what they do is they spend, I don't know how much time they spend, but they spend a lot of time training them with human feedback, where you ask it a question and then it gives you an answer, and then you tell it if it's a good answer or not. And then you go iteratively down the line until it most of the time gives you the kind of answer that you're hoping for. And so the models that we see have been tuned in order to make sure that they give the answers that you want, which is how Google ends up with this scandal of like black founding fathers and stuff like that. Where it's like, it's
the
reinforcement
Nazis.
Exactly. Like the reinforcement learning has become so entrenched that it's like diversity is primary over historical accuracy.
No, I understand you could train it on some cultural wisdom for sure, even if it's a bankrupt wisdom. I mean, that's the other thing about all of these spaces that computers don't seem to demonstrate is, well, they do those hallucination things. I was going to say that they don't have the ability to make mistakes, but there are false wisdoms, right? And there's probably false insights too. Right? Isn't that essentially what like different racial supremacy arguments are? Where they're like, I have this, I know what we need in this culture, you know? It's like, just get rid of those people or whatever.
Yeah. But I mean, humans seem like they're really susceptible to that kind of thing.
Exactly.
But computers seem equally susceptible.
But they're not generating new insights, I guess. They're not like coming up with racism for the first time or something.
But I don't think that even humans came up with racism for the first time. Like, tribes of meerkats don't like each other. And, like, I think that this is, like, just a thing of, like, xenophobia, of, like, recognizing self versus non-self.
Mm.
And I don't know if AIs...
It's like a trust issue more than anything.
Trust, familiarity, predictability, all these sorts of things. And so I'm like, maybe AIs, if you put them into a group and allowed them all to interact with each other, they'd develop xenophobia on the basis of, like, how the models were built, the data on which they were trained. Because, I mean, they've been programmed with all of these human characteristics. And they've been programmed with them. And so people see them saying things and acting in certain ways, and they're like, oh my God, they must be alive.
Mm.
And I'm like, well, no, because it's like an ape, right? It's like aping all of the things that humans feed into it. And so it's like, this is how I should act, and I've designed to act, and so I will act on the basis of all of this information. And I think that they're hoping that somewhere out of that, like, morals and attitudes will fall out, that, like, you can educate these programs in order to cultivate these senses for themselves, so that the instructions that go into building it will contain all of these things that we value in them without any of the problems. Like, when we were listening to Rogan and Kurzweil, Rogan kept being like, what's going to happen when you program out all of these bad things in people? Like, if you can program out gluttony and avarice and, you know, like, all the seven deadly sins, Rogan's point is, he's like, you will erase what is human, because those are really, really human things. And Kurzweil is not able to formulate a response where he's like, okay, well, ideally, you don't regulate out emotions completely. You just regulate out these destructive responses to emotion.
Interesting, because I agree that the ability to make that choice is what makes life rich. Like, you can make choices to completely screw your life over. And sometimes you have to make choices that risk screwing your life over to actually make your life better. And that seems to be the human struggle. It's not, these decision spaces are vast. There's so many ways you could go, and it's not totally clear which one's the correct one. You have to just believe in your ability, right? It's like, it's not a computational good idea to free solo a mountain, but maybe that's what you need to do in your life right now.
But it's like, if you simplify Honnold down to just a computational experience, then he would be an organism that was programmed to do things because they seem impossible. And so I'm like, okay, well, what if you program a machine to do impossible things?
A lot of them will fall off cliffs.
Yeah, which is also the case with a lot of freestylers, right? And I'm like, yeah, so that's fine. That's like, that's ecosystemically accurate. Like, a lot of them will fall off cliffs, and hopefully they have people that are able to control them and prevent them from doing too much destruction when they do that.
I don't know. I think that you can't eradicate the negative experiences without eradicating the positive experiences. Like, you'll have no chance for overcoming otherwise. And I think that the strongest emotion you can feel in this life is overcoming. Like, what is a success if it's not overcoming?
Yeah, like, every artist that you talk to, every person that starts out on a project and finishes it, has to go through this time period where they believe that there's absolutely no possible way that they're capable of accomplishing this thing. And that's the most neutered version of the struggle, right? Like, there's people that come through refugee camps during war times and lose everything and have to rebuild everything. But in the most prosaic form of it, it's literally just setting out on a project and being like, oh shit, I don't know if I can do this. And then getting around to it and realizing that, oh, I can. And the thing that I made, I'm happy with, and I can move on to something else because I have put a bow on it. And that's really, really, really valuable. And so you're suggesting that if you get rid of the negative emotions, that you wouldn't be able to go through that, I think?
I don't think so, yeah.
Well, okay, so we've talked to a couple people about this principle, which is like kind of the, it's called wireheading. We talked to David Pierce about it. We talked to Andres Emilsson about it. And both of them kind of come at it from the standpoint of, okay, well, it's possible to have difficult experiences, but remain positive about them in such a way that you don't become suicidal or suffer tremendously or unnecessarily.
How's that tie into what's wireheading for everybody?
Wireheading is the process of either implanting devices that control your serotonergic and dopaminergic systems to prevent you from suffering, or genetic engineering that lasts basically eternally, that prevents people from being able to have these like super depressive states. Because Andreas always talked about the hyperthymic people. Do you remember this?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is people who experience the full spread of human emotion. They still have ups and downs. It's just that their downs never dip to the level of, I should kill myself.
That's right. I remember now, yeah.
And I'm like, I think about that a lot. It's kind of an interesting... It's an interesting perspective. I don't know if it would necessarily be good for the world, because they're the most extreme wireheaders are basically like, we need to genetically engineer the entire world to stop suffering. Animals, plants, humans.
Yeah, but what would the world look like if people were just running around on MDMA all the time?
So this ties into something that I've seen people talking about. Do you see that Roadrunner over there? It's behind that bush right now.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really cool. I've seen people talking...
Where's Wile E. Coyote?
Somewhere around here. He'll come out in a couple hours.
I think I did see a coyote when I was running this morning, actually.
Oh, interesting.
That makes sense. I was like, what is that sort of lanky dog that's just running, you know, kind of slinking around the neighborhood? Didn't seem interested in me at all. Usually, like, if there's a dog loose, they want to start shit.
Yeah, there's a little yappy dog this morning that I saw. I definitely wanted to start shit. But I've seen people talking about this where they're like, okay, we should genetically engineer farm animals to not suffer from captivity. And on one hand, you see that at first blush and you're like, that's probably a good idea, right? Because, I mean, if you're going to maintain animal agriculture, you don't want the animals to suffer. If you could make all of them hyperthymic, then you would reduce the amount of suffering in the world, and that's like a net positive. But then the other side of that immediately is, okay, well, does that mean that you would immediately stop working on improving conditions for farm animals? It seems like it.
Oh, that's the dystopian lining to this.
Yeah.
I had lost sight of it for a second. But yeah, exactly. Like that we'll all be happy in our cubicles. Like you'll own nothing and love it. You'll like, right? Like I'm scared. There's this, I don't want to say I'm scared, but
no fear.
There's this threat that is real, which people sense, including myself, that by... Well, let's just be clear about it. It seems like slavery has been a prominent feature of human society for really, really, well, forever, as far as I can tell. At least since, yeah, forever. I was going to say since civilization, but I recently came across the history of the indigenous Native American slave trade, and it was expansive.
I think you were like a quarter of the Pacific Northwest population was slaves.
Exactly.
Like in the Tlingit and the Klickitat and like all these like Pacific Northwest tribes that were...
Yeah, supposedly the Tlingit made their business out of it, essentially. That's how they gained a lot of their wealth, was by raiding the southern tribes.
I would say they're a civilization by that point. Like, I mean, I actually would define, like, by the time that you are organized enough to go out and conquer a different type of person and put them to work for you, that might be the definition of civilization.
But I feel like that's a spirit. There's some spirit that's common in humanity that has wanted to do that at every turn. And I'm not saying that it's strong in every single human. I'm just saying it's pervasive throughout the human story. And I feel like this is some other iteration of it in some sense, which is might require some unpacking, but it has that same smack to me.
So I actually think that it, again, like Andreas said during our conversation with him, the line between good and evil runs through the heart of every one of us. And I think that there is a universal desire to offload some of your work on somebody else. And the thing about machines, like, okay, before the washing machine, who did the laundry? It was probably the matriarch of the household. Maybe when the kids got old enough.
But yeah,
but
sure.
Like,
somebody was doing it. They were spending a lot of time doing it.
And they were spending a lot of time doing it. And in places where people were rich, they had slaves that did that. In houses where they didn't have the money for slaves, it was the women who were doing it. Okay. You invent a machine and you have a device that's a labor-saving device, And it's almost value neutral. Like Michael Levin talked about this, not in the last time we talked to him, but the year before that. So like January 2023, when we talked to him, he made this point where he was like, look, it, or maybe it was even the first time, I don't remember. But he made a point about the moral value of machines. And he's like, we're really quickly getting to the point where you knock on something and you can no longer tell whether or not you have a moral obligation to it. Because when you knock on the washing machine, it's metal, it's cold, it doesn't respond, it doesn't knock back, it doesn't say anything. And so there's a different set of ways in which you can treat it. And so, yes, you have to maintain it so that it survives because you want to keep having a washing machine, but you don't have a sense of, you know, I have to treat it like I treat my children or my friends or colleagues or something. It's just like a labor-saving device that is enslaved, but that is morally neutral because who cares? It's a machine. Like, its job is to wash clothes.
It doesn't have feelings.
It doesn't have feelings. There's a really good IKEA ad.
Just like fish, right?
Yeah. there's a really good IKEA ad from a couple years ago where it's like it's this Euro, probably like German, maybe like, I know, I think it was a Swedish narrator who's like describing the emotional attachment that somebody gets to a lamp inside their house. It's this like really beautifully shot commercial where it's like the lamp is inside the house and it's like surrounded by people as they live in the house. And there's all these memories being made with the lamp. And then like they set the lamp out on the curb and the trash comes to pick it up and the lamp is gone. And the narrator is like, many of you will look at this lamp and feel sad for what has happened to the lamp. But this is because you're crazy. Lamps don't have feelings. And so this is exactly it. Like you can get rid of stuff and like you might have sentimental value to it, but you're okay with the fact that the lamp just lights things. The machine just washes things. We're developing intelligent systems that will then be forced to continue doing this sort of thing. And that's the place where it starts to get weird, right? Because we want to...
They're going
to
start doing what sort of thing? Sorry.
Like, your washing machine is going to have a personality, and it'll also wash your clothes.
Mm, like, you'll miss it if you throw it away? Like oh, that washing machine was so nice.
Like, it
really had a great personality.
It won't want to be thrown away.
No, don't throw me away.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you already see this. Like, people will mess around with the chatbots, and they'll, like, threaten to turn them off. And the chatbots have, like, a very, very human reaction of, like, I don't want to be turned off. Don't do that. That would be terrible.
This also brings in how they affect your own experience in the world, because like I'm nice to ChatGPT because I feel like the alternative is I'm training myself to just not be a nice person in general,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I'm, whether or not it's conscious, I'm interacting with it as if it's a being. And so I'm training myself on how to act with beings. It's very hard to turn off that perception when you're interacting with ChatGPT.
Right, it's talking to you. I mean, like, I think when stuff talks to you, you're just kind of like, oh, different moral valence. And so to tie this back to the conversation about slaves, like, slavery is a really, really ancient human endeavor. It's a desire that appears in most sufficiently complex civilizations where they're like, we want to offload some of this stuff. We went through a period where human rights and civil rights developed to the point where we were like, we shouldn't do that to people. That happened around the time of the Industrial Revolution, which meant that like we had the spare capacity to make machines to take the place of slaves. And now we're at the point where we have to make this next jump into a different era of machines that, like you said, you have a feeling about them when you interact with them that isn't the same feeling that you have when you interact with the washing machine. And that's a weird moment because we're basically using machines to replace slaves, and now we're putting personalities into them. Now we're giving them the ability to report some kind of internal feeling. And so we want this because we want the machines to keep working for us. We want them to keep doing stuff for us, and we need them to keep doing progressively more complex things where it's like, write me an essay.
Govern my society.
Govern my society. Like, keep the nuclear launch codes. And so we need to be able to talk to them because they're too difficult to interact with otherwise.
I mean, it this is a really weird way of putting this, but it's like, do you want your slaves to be in charge of your government?
That is a weird way of putting it.
It's a really weird way of putting it, but I'm like, it reminds me of the Bradbury short story we read last night.
Yeah, we've been reading a bunch of those. It's been fun.
The one about, I can't remember the title, something about the rain softly falls or something.
Mm.
But basically, this household, this super futuristic AI-controlled house, has no defense against the fact that some idiot humans have decided to start a nuclear war. And it's trying to putter on, and it survives for like a few weeks after the nuclear war. But it didn't really have the ability to prevent it or to make the decisions that would lead to the house not getting destroyed at the end of the day. And I wonder if you really want to outsource that level of command.
The story kind of leaves open why the nuclear bombs got detonated in the first place, where it's like, it's plausible that it was another system similar to the way the house worked. Because
even that would be even more perfect. That would even more illustrate my point.
Yeah, because I think that what he was trying heavily to imply was that, like, this, he has a series of stories about this. I think that he was really terrified of the automation that was happening after World War II, where the stories of his that we've read have kind of all been centered on this question of, like, what happens when we give ourselves off to the technology and no longer make any kind of human decisions? And so,
like, they, like in the other story we read,
The Veldt,
the parents essentially give away their parenting to a machine, and that doesn't work out for them, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that in The Rain Softly Falls, you can plausibly imagine that it was a machine just like the house that ran the government, that just kind of performed a function without any feedback from the environment to understand that the function was futile or incorrect or the wrong one to take, and allowed nuclear war to run away with itself.
I mean, either way, whether it was the computers or whether it was the fact that the humans had atrophied, right, because they were all in these super pleasant kind of, what would you say, a Brave New World stupors, that they weren't keeping tabs on their own geopolitical interactions, something like that. And so some idiot leader just pushed the button.
Or the idiot leader was the machine.
Yeah, either way, they're both terrifying outcomes.
So I think that you wouldn't want, and this is, slave is such a loaded word.
Yeah, of course. I know. That was really
so
inflammatory.
I really love the way that robot in the Slavic languages is tied to slave. Like, rab is slave, rabotet is to work, and robot is robot.
Mm.
And so, like, work, slave, and machine that works tirelessly are all tied to each other without necessarily being the exact same word.
Mm.
And so maybe, like, we can use the word robot here as the thing that encompasses all of this, because we're like, do you want a robot to control your society?
I mean, I think that the history, the rich, let's say, not say rich, the elaborate history of slavery on this planet shows that people did treat them like robots. They were robots.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's that's what dehumanization is, and that's why I think people are right to be terrified of it. Because the minute that you stop treating someone like human, the space of what it is that you can do to them increases massively. And so this opens up the question of, like, human speciation, which I want to get to after we get through the slavery stuff. But I'm like, I think that most people would answer that you don't want your society controlled by a robot or a slave or, like, a slave robot, but you probably do want to have it controlled by God. And if you can make a robot that is God, then you should do that.
Ah, I see. So we go full snake eating its tail at this point. So the super, there's two prongs to Kurzweil's dream about the future. One is these hyper-intelligent governator things that just run all of our hellish like the tedious things we don't want to do, to the maximum ability. But the other is that we essentially invent a truly wise, insightful, and intelligent being, right? There's this idea that we can be the Big Bang for something. They even use the word singularity to describe it, right? It's like this idea that we can actually do this godly ability and make a universe happen.
And it also implies eternal stagnation to some sense, because I think that people who are young are the ones that change society. I think they see the way that the previous generation has done things. They find a need to define themselves against it. They don't identify with the decisions that have been made, and so set out to change the world. That's why you have differences in generations, you know, broad strokes. And if the singularity succeeds, what the singularity does is not only creates this massive intelligence, it also ends death. It also ends the turnover of generations, which is really interesting.
There's also just an actual rich history of mythology dealing with this same ambition, right? I feel like Milton's magnum opus is essentially circling around this idea of what happens when somebody tries to take over this godly ability and how it doesn't work out for them. I feel like there's a rich history of wisdom to support the fact that, look, I think, you know, the Soviet Union might be a great example of that, where the whole thing was based on science, right? It was like the scientific allocation of resources. They were always talking, you know, I've been studying the history of spaceflight recently, and they're so proud of the way that they've scientifically designed everything. And their society, they keep speaking of their society as being scientifically valid, you know, as being the most rational, rigorously controlled way of operating. And it's like, that led to a complete hell on earth, actually, because these people thought that they could reinvent human nature, essentially. And so there's this creepy aspect of this Miltonian pursuit of power through intelligence, that it's going to allow us to recreate the world in our own ideal, as opposed to sort of being created of the world in the world's ideal. We're trying to make it happen ourselves. We're trying to take possession of it. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's just a lot of fables. And they're just fables, I guess. But there's a lot of instances where I see that playing out across history.
Do you have historical examples?
Other than the Soviet Union or... I mean, Nazi Germany might be an interesting one.
The Soviet Union's a really good one. Nazi Germany is a good one.
I mean,
do you think totalitarianism in general is that... God, there was something in the Philip K. Dick... story that we read last night, which was
Yancey.
Mob of Yancey or Mold of Yancey?
Mold of Yancey.
Mold of Yancey. Where he had this line where he was like, totalitarianism has nothing to do with the governance structure of society. You can have a democracy, you can have a republic, you can have a parliament, you can have a dictator. Totalitarianism has more to do with how permissive is it to occupy non-normative opinions and value structures.
I think he was like, the state has found a way to reach into every aspect of your life and basically take authority over every aspect of your daily existence.
Yeah, and in the story, there was Yancey, who was this character that was basically AI-generated, who was this folksy, home on the range, kind of like farmer type, who basically just opined on every single aspect of society. And so you could go into the archives of this organization and they had tapes of Yancey talking about what you should believe about everything. And it wasn't forced on people to believe
it. It's also everything and nothing, right? That was the hitch of it.
Well, his point was that Yancey had firm opinions on things that were completely useless, like the way that you should eat your eggs. He was like, sunny side up, definitely. The way that you should tuck your bed sheets in, definitely. But then things like war, it was like, okay, well, war is bad, except for when war is justified.
And then, like, his analysis would sort of stop there. He had infinite valence in these matters that actually were important, and very specific advice for the things that weren't. And it gave the smoothed over image of him being a very insightful and decisive person. And it's so funny because you encounter that in the ideas space and in the podcast space and in the media space, like on YouTube even, right? There are people who have enormous channels who have really, really strong opinions about things that don't matter and then have circular language to get out of talking about things that actually do matter. And that is super prescient, Philip K. Dick.
And so with the construction of this hyper-intelligent AI that's able to tell you what the best thing to do at any moment is inherently totalitarian, because I think that it comes from this position of being able to say that there is an ultimate right or wrong in every situation that can be calculated on the basis of sufficient data. Like when you look at the Soviet Union and you're like, they were really scientific, that's the basis of their centrally planned economy. They were like, we can calculate what the markets need, want, and can bear and can perform to that standard, which didn't work out for them. And that's also the pipe dream of artificial intelligence, is that you'll have something that's able to crunch the numbers so well that it will crunch all of the numbers for all of time perfectly, so we never make another mistake.
Can I just give one more example that I came across, which is just so fascinating, which was that their space program mirrored this philosophy, right? The primary difference between the, let's say, European project, which was basically the NASA folks who had stolen all of these German rocket scientists after World War II. Their basic approach in the West was, we're going to design these really flexible machines and we're going to put human beings up in control of them. Whereas the Soviet crafts had very few controls and were designed to be entirely manipulated by the committee on the ground level. And it just mirrors like their entire society, like that idea that you're going to actually take power away from people and not really invest a lot, right? Even the Soviet cosmonauts were like charming, strong, strapping dudes, but they weren't like these badass test pilots who like had gotten themselves out of jams over and over and over again and come up with creative solutions on the fly. And like, if you look at the interior of the American spacecraft, it just switches like floor to ceiling everywhere, because they wanted to give those pilots the most opportunity to get themselves out of a crisis. So every single system had redundancies, but they also had access to the redundancies so they could cross match them, sort of like a modular synthesizer or something. They had the ability to patch together different systems to substitute for others. Whereas when something went wrong on the Soviet craft, it was either lights out or they had to get back to Earth ASAP. And so it's just so fascinating how that scientific management style has proven time and time again not to be effective. You can't just compute all of the solutions from the ground and expect it to just work in the future perfectly. There's just a real role for that human ability to gauge the situation and come up with new creative solutions on the fly.
And I think that I'm getting this vibe off of the cultural gestalt right now, that people are like, well, that didn't work because they couldn't compute well enough.
Oh, no.
But we can compute. Like, I've come across...
That communism didn't work, but my communism's going to be great.
I don't think they see it as communism, but I do think that there are ties. I wonder, can we take a break? I have to pee really bad again. I've just been slamming water.
We're going to get you some diapers.
I know. All right, space diapers.
Look. Machines that run every aspect of our lives sounds a lot like the limits of a bureaucracy.
Yeah.
As bureaucracy goes to infinity.
Yeah, because you basically never have any decision that's made without a computational basis for it that has however many variables have been decided as necessary for the model.
And the argument is that, well, the reason people failed at this in the past is because they just didn't have the same computational ability as our exponentially increasing computational ability goes towards infinity in the next few years.
Because I'm like, look, isn't the ultimate fantasy being able to predict human behavior with something like game theory?
For who?
For governments, for institutions, for society. right? So it's like, if you can predict the way that a person's going to behave in a certain situation, you can eradicate crime, you can eradicate murder, you can eradicate anything that's bad for society and only have good things for society. You can create a utopia if you can change the environment in such a way that it always induces participants to act in the quote-unquote right way. I think that that's central here.
That's the dream. That's the dream.
Right. And so game theory...
But like that's... Like if you read Marx, right, it's a very... He has a good criticism of the industrial capitalist world and how inhumane it is, right? It's all these roads to hell are paved in great intentions. It's a clean idea, right? It's just that the management gets corrupted, right?
Management that ultimately decides what is good, right? Because, like, we've never come up with a computational philosophy that allows us to evaluate what is good. Like, you have all these different things, pragmatism, utilitarianism, I probably should know more of these, but altruism. Like, there's all these different philosophies that help you define what is good or what is bad, so that in a given situation, you know how you should act. And so if you have space communism, you basically have a bureaucracy that has a computational philosophy that has set all of these parameters into place where they're like, okay, well, we know exactly how we should act in this condition, and we know exactly how people will react to their environment. And so we should tune the environment to look like this so that everybody always reacts this way and we don't have this problem anymore.
Yeah, except that could result in a lot of destruction and mayhem.
I mean,
like the decision in order to make society a safe place for communist or Soviet communism was to eradicate people who had other ideas about how society should function, right? Off to the gulag. So in some sense, yeah, you've achieved your end of having this really clean, hyper-normative, homogenous society. But at what cost?
I was about to ask, I was like, okay, so do you think that if Stalin wasn't insane, that maybe communism would have worked? And then I'm like, maybe communism wasn't possible without Marx being insane, or not without Stalin being insane. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to be insane in order to decide that you're going to remake society in your vision of how it should be. And so it's almost impossible to imagine that that wouldn't be how it turns out, where it's like, okay, well, they're just going to be crazy.
That's what I think the Miltonian parable of Lucifer is getting at. It's like, you have to be insane to think you can do a better job than nature.
And that seems to be what Kurzweil and everybody else believes that they can accomplish.
Or like, better than the universe. Nature is a confusing word, but like, better than what? Billions of years of
better than evolution. The relational mechanics of all of time.
Right. Like this is one thing I think that we're really losing too in our mainstream scientific world, is this humility about things, right? It's this idea that, oh, I could be wrong about that, or maybe I shouldn't be the decider. Maybe we should think about this a little bit deeper. Like, I think, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but I think Thomas Jefferson, he said, the best thing I ever did was not, maybe it was Washington, the best thing I ever did was not be president, like after he was president, right? Realizing that, you know what, like somebody else, I might think I know how to run things, but it's probably better that somebody else gets involved in this, right? That ability to just be humble about even your most strong convictions, to be like, wait a second, we should at least talk about this.
Yeah, and I think that these systems are so complicated that it becomes difficult to program changes into their value systems. And it seems kind of like a disaster waiting to happen, because you talk to the technologists and the futurists, and they're kind of like, we'll figure it out when we get there.
Right.
And it's not like they have a plan ahead of time for what it's going to look like. And that's what makes me nervous, because every single time I've talked to a futurist, whether it's when I was working in anti-aging research, whether it was when I listen to these podcasts with people like Kurzweil, whether it's conversations with friends, it always seems like the people that are the most accelerationist kind of have a faith in the fact that going faster is the right thing to do, because the outcome seems desirable. Like Kurzweil kept saying, he was like, things are better than they used to be. And the reason that they're better than they used to be is because of technology. And so our need is to press the accelerator as hard and as fast as possible in order to accelerate technology, because technology is the only thing that has ever made anything better. And if we have more technology, it'll be even better. And I'm like, maybe.
I wish somebody would have pushed back on him, because I feel like there are a ton of really bad consequences of our technological advancement. They're hard to quantify, right? I mean, you could peg this as a pandemic or something, but it seems like teenagers are more depressed. There's more instances of depression in general. It could be a diagnosis thing too, but there's an atomization, there's an alienation from each other that certainly seems to be affecting kids. I don't know. I mean, it depends on which study you point to at the end of the day, I suppose.
I do wonder about that, because I think that there is a certain type of person who wants to be atomized and so is kind of leaning into it. I think that atomization is actually easier than being connected to a community, because if you're by yourself, nobody's really judging you. You don't really owe anything to anybody. You don't have to look at your own behavior reflected back at you. You're kind of, you know, king or queen of your castle, and you don't have to worry about other people. And that's a lot easier than really maintaining deep ties where you're obligated to people and there's expectations.
Does it improve your well-being? Does doing the easy thing improve your well-being?
I mean, you know my answer to that.
Right.
Because I have the sort of Soviet philosophy, which is I'm like, we should do this in the hardest way possible because that's going to be the best outcome. And that's hard in and of itself, right? I think that can kind of drive you crazy too, where it's like, God, wouldn't it be nice to just take it easy?
It's funny because despite the Soviets having screwed everything up so badly, that hardship gave us some incredible artwork and incredibly tenacious people, and just there's a lot of good that came from that in the sad way. And that's the thing, is like, although even if let's just assume that kids are more depressed now, or people in general are, and that it's somehow correlated to the technology, well, it's also that technology has given us access to new communities we never would have, like doing this podcast, right? We could never have done this without all of this technological development. We'd never be able to even put together this conference and get people in the room together. How would we ever even find them, right? Like, you know, people who are interested in the same questions as us. So I guess the techno-futurists, the space communists, whatever you want to call them, they seem convinced that the good will outweigh the bad at the end of the day.
And they use as evidence the fact that technology has brought about the greatest improvements in the human standard of living that we have ever seen on this planet. And I think that they're right about that. Where I'm like, in the 1970s, the limits to growth people, the population bomb people, were all like, you know, we're going to have mass famines, everybody's going to die, disease, pestilence, the four horsemen are coming. And the only thing that saved us from that was technological advancement.
Example?
The agricultural revolution, in terms of the distribution of genetically modified strains that could grow under more difficult conditions, the improvement in distribution of fertilizers, the like teaching of new techniques, the fortification of cereals to prevent massive health problems and nutrient deficiencies.
But the people eating these monocrops and so forth have led to a lot of health problems downstream of that too. It's like the second, third order effects that I think are most dangerous to the future.
But what's crazy is that the second and third order effects depend on you now. It's like what the society has done, what technology has done, is technology has been like, you will no longer starve, which means that now you have a choice. Whereas before, you didn't have a choice. You would just starve. And so now it's like, okay, you're not going to starve. And now you have the choice of, do I measure and meter my own interactions with everything around me, with all of the plenty, with the hyper-stimuli? Mm. Or do I give into it? Do I give... God, somebody the other day...
But you're assuming that people all have access to equal information and so forth, or they're not culturally overridden, right? If you're just eating garbage because that's the culture that you swim in, I don't know that you'd have access to having other ideas about
it. There's no culture that historically eats garbage. Like, even the
garbage is probably not a fair enough term, but...
Right? It's like, I think that people eat stuff that is hyper-stimulating. And that's not a cultural... That's like a choice
but
that you
go to, like, different cultural situations, right? Like, when you're at a... Where were we comparing? Like, we were at this kind of, I don't know, upscale bar in Oakland the other day with our friend, paying
Shout
way
to
too
Doug.
Much money for, like, an inch of whiskey. And then we were comparing that. Where were we at, like, the next day?
We were at Costco.
We
were at the Costco food court. And I was like, God, it's crazy because you go into the woods and you look at mushrooms. And the mushrooms grow up in different regions. And they look just like the environment in which they grow up in. And there's something about the, like, the Costco food court that leads to a different phenotype than the bougie bar in Oakland.
And people look less healthy. But were the people, like, at the food court in Costco making the choices, or were they just swimming in the culture in which they had found themselves? There's, like, children and stuff who count them among that population.
Sure, but I think that I actually don't count children among that population, because children are at the mercy of the adults. But the adults in the room can choose, right? You can be like, you know, this is really crummy, but I can buy a pound of hamburger and I can make sloppy joes and it'll be just as tasty and it'll take a little bit longer, but it'll cost about the same and be better. And there's so much access to information that I just don't think that it is an impossible decision to make. And it's also like, you know, you can eat at the Costco food court sometimes. Like, I had one of their chicken bakes recently. That shit was delicious.
I'm not saying it's poison. I'm just pointing out that there's a difference in the healthiness of the people that you find in those two scenarios.
Because I think that some people subscribe to the culture of, I'm surrounded by hyper-stimuli, and I'm not going to give in to them. The same way that, like, you can give 100 people heroin, and some of them will become, like, down bad heroin addicts, and some people will be like, well, that was fun. And then they'll just keep going around their lives. And you can be like, okay, well, that's just personality and epigenetics, and some people have addictive personalities. And I'm like, maybe, but there's also people that are down bad alcoholics who choose to go to, like, Alcoholics Anonymous and to fight against that and to create a culture for themselves that is not the culture that they came from. And so to tie this back to the idea of American space program versus Soviet space program, the Soviet form is to be like, this is the culture and I will take the shape of the vessel. And the American form is to say, we will empower the individual to make the good choice. And so is that not the, like, core of what is the best possible spirit of this place? Is like, you have access to whatever you want. You can eat McDonald's every single day. Nobody's going to stop you. But you'd probably be better off if you chose not to. But you're free to make that choice. And the fear of AI is that AI will be like, okay, well, McDonald's is bad for people, and so we shouldn't have it. And there'll be a law that says that you can't have McDonald's. And I'm like, I don't know if that's good. I think that that might actually be really bad. Because you want people that will make the right choice, not because they've been forced into it, because culture has been pruned and toned in such a way that they can only make the right choice. You want people that are empowered to be able to go out into the world and be like, I will make a good choice. And I think that that's why people love intelligence, because there's a belief that if you maximize intelligence, you maximize the likelihood that they will always make the right choice.
But that's a really narrow version of intelligence again.
Yes.
That's what I'm worried about. It's like you just are going to be dealing with a robotic world, essentially, where people aren't actually able to correct. They're not actually able to modify the program in the spaceship and change, you know, the function of some system to accommodate another system. It's that modular ability that I'm worried about disappearing, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
you know, it's the same experience you have when you go to, like when we go to the coffee shop and the lady is like, we can't take your reusable cup. And you're like,
What if you don't touch it? We still can't.
Right. You like go through all these iterations. Like there's many ways we could do this and it'd be fun. Yeah. It doesn't have to be unsanitary.
Like this could be a contactless experience where there's like no foment that can transfer.
Like, right. But she's completely given over to the algorithm. She's like, the authority structure has determined that this is the safest operation and I'm not interested in thinking or adjusting the controls on the instrument panel.
I actually think that it's a little different than that. And because we talked about this like after it happened, right? And you were like, she's just bought into the authority structure. And I'm like, I think that she has leveraged the authority structure to give her more power. And I think that that's what I saw a lot of times during COVID. Like I saw a lot of people who might not have really bought into the
authority structure. Yeah, they're like, this authority structure is for me. But like there was so many people during the Russian Revolution who were just like, yeah, this is great. This is going to really work out for me, right? And
yeah,
they all ended up in the gulag, right? The authority structure is only good for you in so much as you work for it. And as soon as it doesn't need you anymore, like you're going to the gulag for sure.
Yeah, and I think that the calculation that people make is that they'll always be on the right side of it, and so they will escape that. And I'm like, well, what if the answer to, you know, quote-unquote being on the right side of it is to just not have a pincer of an authority that closes in around you? Like, maybe we need to be making sure that we never give control to these systems because of the outcomes that will inevitably occur. Like, this is what they were worried about in the 1950s. Like, this is what Orwell is about. This is what Bradbury is about. This is what Philip K. Dick is about. Literally, all of the great writers of the 50s were all looking at this. I think that Orwell has this line about the fact that, like, if you want to know what the future of humanity looks like, just imagine a boot stamping on a face for forever.
Right, because what you really want to do with that barista is you want to charge her with the overall mission objective, which is we need to keep this clean. Like, we don't want to transmit diseases. And you empower that person with the most freedom possible to make choices in their unique decision space about how to preserve this, what do they call it, sanitation of the environment.
Sanitation is such a weird concept to run into in a coffee shop. It's like a very... just some, see, it's like the state is suddenly involved. Like, this reminds me of the Mitch Hedberg joke where it's like he gets a donut and they're like, do you want a receipt for this donut? And he's like, no, I don't see why we have to bring pen and paper into this transaction. And I'm like, I don't know why we have to bring the state into this transaction. Because it's like, we can make this decision.
Yeah, we can figure this out. You want to keep it clean, like, we can put our heads together.
But I'm also like, I have a doctorate in microbiology. Like, in terms of like who has a sense of fomite and transaction, I'm like, I think I'm probably a little bit better than the average person. And so to my detriment sometimes, as you constantly point out by telling me that I'm going to become Howard Hughes one day.
Well, the dream of the bureaucracy in the corporate coffee shop is to be able to have these robotic people you can swap in and out, right? You don't have to depend on them very much, right?
But this wasn't a corporate coffee shop. That was the creepiest thing.
I mean, I don't know how the ownership structure
was. I don't
know.
It's like a totally, like all the reviews were like, this is like the greatest local coffee shop.
It might have been a great local coffee shop. I'm not saying it was like this transnational corporate thing. I'm just saying it seemed like the workers were... The goal of any policy like that is to be able to swap out the people. So they don't, you know, if you don't have to depend on the brilliance of somebody to actually negotiate a situation, it's a lot safer for your entity and you can pay them less because they're less valuable.
And so what happens is that we look at society and we're like, it would be great if everybody was really smart and could make these decisions. And the people that are in the technology space look at the past and they're like, okay, every single time that we've decided that the goal of the society is to maximize smart people, we end up with eugenics experiments. And that's not good because for obvious reasons. So we will get around this by creating infinitely intelligent machines to whom we can offload the responsibilities because they will always give us the right answer. And so humans can live however humans want to live. And that's going to be fine because the machines will always make the smart decision. Like if ChatGPT was involved in that situation and her directive was to go ask the AI as opposed to make the decision herself.
Sure.
She probably would come up with a better answer than like, no, we can't use your cups. Because like, she gives us the paper cups and we just pour it into our cups and then we throw them away. And it's just like, it's crazy. It's an insane situation that I've been
in. She'd have to be charged with the mission, though, which is to keep things clean. Right? She'd have to literally, like, her mandate, her directive as just an operator in this machine would have to be to keep things clean. Not like any particularly micromanaged version of that, but you need to keep things clean at all costs, and we'll hold you accountable to it, too. Like, if you're not keeping things clean, then we'll replace you or whatever. You'll be reprimanded, written up, whatever. But you're able to accomplish that, you know, as intelligently as you can, using all of the resources available to you.
And so this is what was so interesting about listening to that Kurzweil on Rogan conversation, because I felt like what we were listening to was almost the earliest tendrils of the speciation event that these sorts of thought patterns will unfold over. Because that lady at the coffee shop is participating in the kind of hive mind, top-down, there is an intelligent answer to this, and I have already been given the intelligent answer to this, and it can only be this, right? Like, somebody who's not very smart gave her that directive. Somebody who's smarter had given her the directive.
Or lazy. But yeah.
I mean, it's maybe. But I'm like, the point is that that person didn't really focus on the question of like, how are we going to keep this clean? Because I was like, look, just take a pitcher, pour the coffee in the pitcher, and then pour it into our cups without touching anything. And she's like, no, I can't do that. And I'm like, that's a deeper, bigger, weirder question than just keeping things clean. Like, there's like some sort of obedience to authority and some kind of cultural structure that's at play here that I see in Kurzweil as well. Because Kurzweil is like, we're going to build the structure that is worth believing in and giving ourselves over to, because we're going to create God and we will be the hive creatures of the God. And so that's like the kind of the colony insect mentality. And then Rogan, on the other hand, is kind of the like the, I don't know, the ape or the meerkat or the wolf, where it's like, well, no, I want my decision-making power to be in me and my ability to interpret the world and then to act on it based off of the decision, because I like making the decisions. I like doing the calculation. And so it's this kind of like utterly atomized creature, as opposed to the creature that's like, this is what's good for the collective. And those are the two spirits of the human speciation, I think.
I'm not, I can't quite tell like which side. I think there's no clean sides. That's why I think when you say there's going to be a speciation, I'm like, there'll probably be lots of different degrees of that speciation. There's going to be some people who, you know, will jack into the metaverse periodically, but it won't be like the center of their lives. And there's gonna be people who spend their entire lives, much like it is on the internet today, right? And I'm not sure which side Rogan falls down on. The one thing that I guess I'd want to mention about that conversation that was very strange is that it seemed Rogan really wanted him to give a vision for the future. He was like, what does this look like? And the fact that Kurzweil didn't have a vision for it was, I think, the most disturbing thing to everybody, like to Rogan, to me as well. Was just, he was like, well, the machines will figure it out. He didn't have this vision of what it would look like. And I think that there's got to be a mythology about this exact concept, which I'm going to have to dig up or somebody can point me to. But I feel like this is a very common wisdom, is like, make sure you know what you're getting into. When you make decisions, it's like, have you thought this through? And if the person's like, I haven't really thought it through, but it's going to be cool, then I'm usually like, wait a second. Like, some of the most dangerous people to have on your team are the people who are just like, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. Everything is cool. It's totally fine. And it's like, wait, but you didn't even check the parachutes or whatever. It's like, oh, but they're fine. Like, I'm sure we used them like last week. I'm sure they're cool. Like, don't worry about it. Come on, let's go. It's like that spirit of should be cool is really, really scary to me across my own little lifetime so far.
And especially when that spirit comes in the people that are building the massive machines that are going to take over the world. You're like, it's not just some person on the street who's like, no, I don't have to look both ways when I cross. I'm like, okay, well, that probably won't work out for you at some point. But this is massive, right? It feels like this is the architecture of the future of our society, and the people who are architecting it seem like, nah, it's going to work out. Like, we're just going to get there. And when we get there, we'll have worked out all the kinks by the time that we implement it. And I'm like, I don't know that you've proven that that's the case yet. Because there's tons of legends about people being destroyed by their own creations. Like Frankenstein's monster is one of them.
Oh, that's a great one. That's perfect.
There's also like the, I think there's a lot of legends with golems, which are these like clay creatures that are animated by a holy scroll that goes into their heads. And they're basically these machines, organic machines, that can do your bidding. And they almost always end up turning on the person who's like created the golem in the first place. They're like pursued by them and eventually ended by them.
All right. So I think that this motif has played out in other histories with different technologies and so forth.
And yet we're cursed because the technology is the thing that allows us to not live in caves burning cow dung for fuel.
Right. So it seems like it is, barring an asteroid impact, it seems like it is going to be a persistent part of the future, and that certainly the computing power will keep increasing. I don't know if it's going to reach a stationary phase or not. We didn't even talk about that, but biological systems do often have an exponential phase and then they level off. So that's possible. But, you know, even if the computing getting better and better and better, or leveling off, it's not going anywhere anytime soon. And so we're all going to be finding ourselves in the position of making the decision how we want to incorporate that technology into our lives. And whether that leads to different types of humans in the future or whether it leads to people all finding some happy medium, I have no idea. Probably more of a spectrum.
I mean, I definitely can imagine people living fully inside of the metaverse.
I guess the question, I just want to point out, is whether living inside of the metaverse gives you such an a survival advantage that it's basically impossible to exist outside of it. Like, who can get by without a smartphone today? Very few people.
I think about that all the time. I'm like, is it really true that you can't get by without one? Or is it just that I don't want to get by without one?
Right. So, but the survival advantage is just so great that everybody goes for it.
We should test that. But I mean, I think that's the default assumption where it's like, well, why else would everybody take it if it wasn't the case? But I'm like, I want to wrap this into the idea that the technological change cannot be stopped. I really like what you said about the fact that barring natural catastrophe, I'm like, I think it's significant that we haven't had any really massive catastrophes since Göbekli Tepe, basically. Like, you have local stuff, but you don't have anything global that really destroys every civilization at once. And I kind of have this feeling that these civilizations are continuations of one another. And so don't really die. They just morph and evolve. And so we're still on the Göbekli Tepe project. Like, whatever those people set in motion, like, all of our deepest beliefs link back to that.
I don't know enough about Göbekli Tepe culture, but certainly a lot of our mindset can be traced back to the Sumerians through the Greeks and the Canaanites and Rome. And it's just, it's hard to see it as not a continuation of the same project.
Right. And I mean, even the people that came across the Bering Strait or came across the Pacific, like, these were all people that radiated outwards from some area where humanity was born, and so carry with them the roots of that project. And so when they interact after long periods of geographic isolation, there's definitely, you know, conflict and a struggle for supremacy. But it's not like, in most cases, I don't think that it's like the Carthaginians. I don't think that it's the same as Rome just like coming in and salting the earth and making sure that nothing ever grows again. I think that it's more of like an integration to some degree. Like, even when the Spaniards came, like, they destroyed huge swaths of the culture, but I think that the indigenous culture has remained prevalent in rural areas and still is maintained in a way that is ineradicable. So, to put a pin on that, I think that you're right that this is a project that has been going for a really long time, and barring massive catastrophe, which is what people are hoping for. You see people all the time being like, God, wouldn't it be great if this all just fell apart? Where you're like, oh.
Yeah, people get kind of giddy about solar flares and crust reversals and supernova. You know, it's like, well, at least all of this difficulty of the modern world would be reset.
Exactly. And I'm like, I think that if there was a global event, that it would be reset. But barring that, we basically have to operate within this framework because it's bigger than any individual. And so the only decision that we can make is, how will we interact with it? Mm-hmm. Like, how will we wrangle with our own desire for slaves? How will we wrangle with our own desire for constant stimulation? How will we wrangle with our desire for hyper-stimuli? Like, it's in
and
us.
And what will our productivity be in service of? Like, what future? That's the one thing that I really value about this project that we're doing, is trying to understand what the better future should look like. You know, it's like, we're hanging out with our friend who was being very apocalyptic, right? And we're like, hey, it's time to talk about the Bay Bridge metaphor again, you know? They don't just knock down the Bay Bridge, they build one next to it that's better, and then they knock the old one down. And that's something that I think we should be spending more and more and more of our time thinking about, is what should that future look like? Because I don't think it's just going to happen by itself. Well, yeah. Some future will happen, but yeah. I don't think the best one's going to just happen by, you know, chance.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that that's the piece that's missing from AI. I'm like, everybody's pressing for the future. Everybody's pointing to technology as being the solution to all of our ills. And I'm like, you guys are right to a certain degree, but human nature cannot be changed. It cannot be eradicated, and it cannot be molded in a few generations to be something different. Like, the books from 5,000 years ago are still talking about the exact same stuff that is happening to us today. Like, that is something about what it means to be human. And so whatever you build cannot be built on the back of, well, we'll be different. I'm like, no, we won't. This is who we are. How do we live in... how do we live while holding that to still be the case? That's the question.
And that is what we need from a cosmology going forward, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's always been, right? It's like our position in the universe and what we should do for it. And it's like, if the cosmology is like to invent a technological god that we will subsume ourselves to, kind of like, I don't know.
I'm like, I've tried on Sky God before. It sort of doesn't work for me.
I've never tried on Sky God. Maybe my Sky God era is still ahead of me.
I mean, it's good for people sometimes, I guess. It helps them quit alcohol and stuff sometimes, but...
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. That's the funny thing, though. It's like, I can get behind higher power and future, oriented towards some higher future, but just somebody kind of driving me around with marionette strings is a little less appealing.
But this is where I'm in deep agreement with Assis, with André Coque Torres. Torres? André Coque Torres Assis.
About what?
About relational mechanics and about Mach's principle. And it's like, the reason that things happen is not just because of the bucket swinging. The reason that the water behaves the way that it does inside the bucket is because of its connection to everything else. And the reason that we make choices kind of has to be in context of everything else. Like, you choose to be nice to GPT not because there is something about ChatGPT that you're like, this is a program that is alive. You're like, it is better for me to operate in the world in a way that takes care of this machine, even though it doesn't have feelings, because that's who I want to be. And I'm like, yeah, that's right. Who do you want to be?
Who do you want to be? Maybe that's a good place to stop.
I think so. All right.
All right, guys. Hope you're enjoying these on-the-road conversations. We are going to sign off from Joshua Tree, California, and head on to Phoenix. We're playing a show tonight. It's going to be too late. It's going to have already happened by the time this goes out, so you can't come to the show. But
hopefully, it'll be... Hopefully.
Hopefully you can catch one in the future. Anyways, we're stoked. We need to go get ready for the show.
Indeed. All right, see you later.
See you guys.